This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You should worry about methane in the Arctic or the end of the Amazon rainforest, but room air conditioners or Bitcoin? Welcome to the Deadly Details on Radio EcoShock. World leaders get dire warnings about the climate, as they will this week at COP24 in Poland. But even those grim charts are lowball estimates of the real heat coming real fast. So much is left out, as we discover from this new research this week. Just two of many growing technologies can push up the global thermostat. Half a degree more from billions more room air conditioners, half a degree more from the digital currency Bitcoin, and pretty soon it all adds up to real hell. Let's find out how the unintended consequences of small technology could push us off the climate cliff with our guests Ian Campbell and Randy Rollins.
Radio EcoShock.
When I traveled through India in 1979, there were hardly any air conditioners. Now, in this warmer world, millions of people have moved from rural villages to cities. Little room air conditioners sprout like mushrooms from every wall in the cities. And according to a new report, that is just the start in China, India, and all over the world as humans try to cool themselves off on a hotter planet. The Rocky Mountain Institute warns room air conditioners alone could warm Earth by half a degree by the year 2100 on our current path. Unless we can find a better way, that AC is half a degree over the edge into climate disaster, in my opinion. So billionaire entrepreneur Richard Branson is offering $3 million to find better AC technology. To explore this climate threat you probably haven't heard about, we have Ian Campbell on the line. Ian is a senior fellow at the Rocky Mountain Institute and lead author of their report, Solving the Global Cooling Challenge. From Colorado, Ian Campbell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you, Alex. Happy to be speaking to you.
Ian, can we start with a snapshot? Why should we worry about a billion people installing room air conditioners, or RACs, as you call them?
It's really to do with the climate impact associated with air conditioners, and it's actually way beyond a billion. When you look at number of air conditioning units we have in operation around the world today, it's around 1.2 billion, and with the trajectory that we're on, and you know, this is being driven by a combination of population growth, urbanization, rising income levels in developing countries, it's expected we're going to have 4.5 billion. So that's going to be like 3.3 billion more air conditioners in operation, and that has multiple impacts. It certainly has impacts on electricity systems. It has impacts on consumers' pockets, because most consumers, when they buy an air conditioner, have little idea as to how much it's going to cost to operate, and they also have impact on our climate.
You just returned from India, where the Minister of Science and Technology wrote the foreword to your report. When it comes to AC, what do you see on the streets of Mumbai or Delhi, and why is the Indian government so concerned?
You know, we've been speaking to people really around the world about this. We've been researching the space for the last year and a half. And the Indian government was actually the government that seemed to be most aware of what was happening, and which is actually incredible foresight, because when they look in the rearview mirror, they don't see the extent of penetration of cooling within their country that we would see here in the U.S. So in India, there's probably only about 30 million air conditioning units installed, but the expectation is, with a population of 1.1 billion people living in basically hot, humid climate zone, that's going to grow to, when we get to 2050, a billion. And that level, the electricity needed in India to power that many room air conditioners is larger than their existing grid capacity today for all end uses.
So there have been several reports and projections on the future of room air conditioners, and the latest comes from the International Energy Agency, or the IEA. It's called The Future of Cooling. Can you give us just a couple of hints of what they found?
It was very similar, and we did our own research and came to some of the same conclusions in relation to impact. So there's been, really over the last 18 months, there's been a growing awareness of the impact of cooling, and there's a really strong body of work out there. What we wanted to do was to take that a step further and go beyond talking about the issue and the challenge, but start looking at, well, how do we solve for this? I mean, one of the things we looked at was, you know, there's a lot of perspective out there that says, well, you know, we're going to be transitioning our grid infrastructure to be basically renewable energy generation. And, you know, if we do that fuel switch to renewables, that solves the challenge of the growing air conditioning demand. And it actually doesn't. And it would be a huge amount of infrastructure that would have to be put in place to power what is relatively inefficient equipment today, about 2,000 gigawatts of generating capacity. And globally last year, there was only 94 gigawatts of solar generation that came online. So the air conditioning demand actually dwarfs what the amount of renewable currently being deployed is.
Yeah, that's a strange thought that as we add more solar and wind and we're all cheering for that, we're losing at least that by the number of new air conditioners that are quite inefficient being sold around the world.
Yeah, one of the staggering statistics, and we kind of stumbled across this, was that 2017 was a record year for solar deployment around the world, and there was 94 gigawatts installed. That was more than all new fossil fuel generation capacity that came online. But just in 2017, the incremental demand associated with new air conditioners coming into the market was actually over 100 gigawatts. So all of the solar capacity that was deployed, a record year in 2017, wasn't enough to just power that 1 year's worth of air conditioning sales.
So we break down the climate impact of air conditioning into two main factors, and I'm guessing that the first is the power burned, as we've been discussing, and that could come from coal power plants in places like China, India, or Arizona. So that's the main concern, is it, the power being burned?
Yes, it is, and it kind of gets a little complicated because you have things like grid emissions factors coming in, but, I mean, in broad brush terms, in most developed nations that have cleaner generating capacities or resource, it's about 3/5 of the climate impact is associated with the indirect emissions coming from power generation. In most developing countries where it's predominantly coal-fired plants, it's about 4/5 of the climate impact is from the indirect emissions associated with electric use. The remaining climate impact is the impact of refrigerant release through the life cycle of the unit, and the refrigerants that we are using today are particularly harmful from a global warming perspective.
Yes, I'd like to talk to you about those refrigerants more in just a minute, but first, I was surprised to read that the average room air conditioner sold in China is more efficient than what Americans buy. Now, why is that?
Yeah, so that kind of gets into different technologies in different markets, and I would assume that that comparison would be looking at the typical units that are sold in China, which is something called mini splits, which is really not a lot different to what we'd look at as a room air conditioner, but with the condenser and evaporator separated by a refrigerant line. You know, so it's a fairly contained unit, and when you compare that to a forced air unit, then the natural efficiencies associated with that additional step of actually fully conditioning the air is going to make it somewhat less efficient. But one of the things that also I think we see in these mini-split units is the utilization of inverter technology on the compressor, so they tend to perform very well at part load, and I think there's been less of a focus here in the U.S. on part load performance, although that is increasing with the focus on SEER a seasonal energy efficiency ratio rating system.
So late in the 1980s, the world got together with the Montreal Protocol to try and remove CFCs from refrigeration because they were damaging the ozone layer, and the industry came up with an alternative cooling chemical, but that turns out to be a global warming problem. And then we have this agreement that pretty well nobody has heard about. Do you want to talk just for a minute about what the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol is and why that matters?
Yeah, so the Montreal Protocol, I think, was generally viewed as being incredibly successful in relation to the phase-out of ozone-depleting refrigerants and was really, I think, leveraged as a vehicle that had worked to seek agreement from effectively 197 nations to phase out HFC refrigerants, which, as you say, are those that have the high global warming potential. And it was one of those, I think, largely unintended consequences of we move from a refrigerant, a synthetic refrigerant that has ozone depleting potential, and then we jump on refrigerants that, as it turns out, have very high global warming potential. And the Kigali Amendment was actually agreed back end of 2016 and set a timeline for phase out of these HFC refrigerants, which are the ones that have very high global warming impact when released to the atmosphere, such that by 2040, we would be about an 80% reduction from where we are today. So it's a fairly extensive timeline for phase out, but part of that is to ensure that countries, industries have an sufficient time to be able to truly mobilize, because the next generation refrigerants aren't yet fully obvious to us.
Ian Campbell, you previously worked with a multi-billion dollar provider in the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning industry. So you know very well we're cooling everything from giant office towers to shopping malls to football stadiums. Why does this new report from the Rocky Mountain Institute focus almost exclusively on small room air conditioners?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one we asked ourselves a few times as we started to narrow our focus. But I guess two primary reasons. The first one is that if you want to drive impact, you have to focus, because when you dilute your focus across multiple kind of end-use requirements, you start to see that there's going to be differing solution sets that are necessary. So if you want to solve something, you have to pick the one that you want to solve. The reason that we picked the residential is it's the largest and it's the most accessible. So what I mean by that is, you know, 70% of the air conditioning systems out there today are residential, so small, basically apartment and small homes. And they're the most accessible. It's kind of the first step on to a life of air-conditioned comfort, let's say, where in many developing markets, you can take that first step and get an air conditioner to keep your room comfortable of a night when it may be 120 degrees ambient temperature outside, so that you and your family can sleep overnight. And it becomes a very highly desirable purchase, similar to a TV or a refrigerator in a family's kind of criteria of where does their available disposable income go. So for those reasons, plus also it's the segment that is perhaps the hardest to solve, because the procurement decisions being made by consumers, you know, it's very difficult to understand EER and SEER ratings and COP and all these kind of thermodynamically based rating systems. And so the procurement decision is largely made on the price of the unit and does it look nice? And is it a recognized brand? Those are probably the three main criteria. So it's the hardest to solve. So we wanted to pick the biggest, the hardest, and the most accessible to impact first.
And as you know, there's other extreme solutions out there, like geoengineering blocking out sunlight, or building more homes and businesses underground, or we could put a big dome over the city, the sci-fi writers tell us. Are any of those really worth considering, and if so, might they derail that coming wave of room air conditioners?
This is one where our belief is that the impact is so significant when we just look at residential air conditioning and we look at the risk of just that one end use being half a degree of global warming by the base year of 2100. There's so much that we need to do, it becomes an and not an or. So, you know, one of the things we identified in our report was, what if we do everything that we already know how to do? So, you know, increasing minimum energy performance standards, improved building envelopes, more stringent building codes, modifying occupier behavior or influencing occupier behavior to, you know, have wider temperature bands within buildings. And so many, many things, and it doesn't come close to abating that half a degree impact that will happen on a business as usual pathway, which was why we said, well, we believe we need to have a dramatically more efficient technology for cooling. And we also believe that, you know, based upon landscaping of what's out there, that it's also possible. So that was the path that we took, but this is an and. And, you know, one of the things that we would also believe is great is in residential new development, district systems are actually, you know, a super efficient way to be able to provide cooling to many buildings as opposed to having discrete systems or pieces of equipment on every building, especially in dense urban environments. So there's lots of solutions. We shouldn't preclude any. Our focus, though, is laser focused on the efficiency of standalone residential cooling systems, because that doesn't require behavior change. When you have it embedded within the technology, you know that efficiency will deliver.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Ian Campbell, Senior Fellow at the Rocky Mountain Institute. We are talking about how to cool you off in a hotter world without making global warming worse. At least that's the hope. Now, I love all the facts and figures in this report, Ian, solving the global cooling challenge. It is in plain English with lots of good graphs. Anybody could read it at rmi.org, and I hope they will. But the ending's a little frustrating. You don't provide a great solution. You don't tell us what the technology is. Why not?
So we actually, in conjunction with launching the report, with the support of Mission Innovation, which is an initiative of the Clean Energy Ministerial and the Government of India, and a number of other supporters, including, as you mentioned, Sir Richard Branson, we actually launched a global cooling prize. And you know, one of the things which we did in conjunction with the report was we did a lot of landscaping to understand what we felt was possible. But when you're looking for a next generation technology, someone's described that as like looking for a needle in a haystack. But when you run a prize, the needle comes to find you. So we launched the prize earlier this month in Delhi in India. The reason we did it in Delhi in India is it's going to be the world's largest market for air conditioning over the next 30 years. And to get industry's attention, you need to have a large market. And so we picked the largest one. And the approach that we took was not to be prescriptive about technologies, but just to define an outcome. So a line in the sand of performance for a next generation cooling technology, and then effectively let the market have at it and see what comes up that is closest to the full set of criteria that we've stated. And assuming that we have multiple and diverse technologies getting through that first stage to then effectively pick a or even a number of winners that we can work with going forward. So we didn't want to be prescriptive on technologies, and we have to be very careful now we launched on the prize to not effectively imply any technology bias, because we want to see as many diverse technologies come through as possible.
Suppose I come up with a new type of air conditioner and it doesn't use global warming gases and it requires much less energy. I win this global cooling challenge and industry starts pumping out new design AC units. But then we have the Jevons paradox, where greater efficiency leads to greater use. What stops another billion homes installing the new AC and therefore multiplying the total power use beyond your worst projections?
Yeah. So actually, we did model for that. You know, one of the things we did was we modeled for the extent of the climate impact, but also grid impact associated with the business as usual. We then said, okay, our criteria is 5 times lower climate impact, which is largely going to come from improved efficiency. In fact, it has to be at least 4 times on efficiency to be able to get 5 times less climate impact, with the remaining piece being associated with the refrigerant. And we modeled the impact of that, but said that it's likely that there will be a rebound effect where consumers are perhaps wary of how much it costs to operate the unit today. If it costs a quarter of the cost to operate it in the future because there's a super efficient technology, will they run it for more hours? And unfortunately, I think the answer to that question is yes. And we did model the impact associated with that. But a unit using 4 times less energy, at least 4 times less energy, that rebound effect, although it has an impact, is pretty modest in relation to what you've achieved because of the leapfrog in technology.
I have another small quibble with the report, and I'm sure you're aware of this. You can't include everything, but saying room AC could create an additional half a degree of warming assumes a more or less linear relationship between gigatons of carbon emitted and the warming that results. But I talk with scientists who say we don't know Earth's climate sensitivity. You know, an additional half a degree of warming from AC or Bitcoin or whatever may trigger natural responses like deforestation or deglaciation of Greenland. So that little half a degree may produce another big degree of warming. So is it a worry to rely on straight calculation of gigatons to temperature?
Yes, it is, but I'm not sure we're smart enough to do anything other than apply a linear relationship to that, which is obviously what most folks have done in this space. And it is only indicative, but you know, one of the challenges is when we look at 2100 and we look at a cumulative gigaton of CO2 equivalent, you know, we're looking at about just over 700 gigatons by 2100. And if we communicate that it's 700 gigatons, I'm not sure that means much to many of the people that will just see the headlines and, you know, kind of pick up the summaries of some of the analysis and work that we've done. So we felt compelled to put that into terminology that is more readily understood, but obviously we do understand that it's far from a perfect correlation, and obviously we've assumed that perfect linear correlation, which is not reasonable, but we believe it is indicative.
Ian, from your travels and your experience in the AC industry, do you have any doubt that as the world heats up, humans will adopt air conditioning to survive?
I have no doubt. If you think of where the air conditioners, so I kind of mentioned that we've got 1.2 billion air conditioners installed around the world. Most of those are in developed nations, and most developed nations sit in more temperate climates. And so we're talking of places like Europe, like North America, like Japan. But what we're going to see is by 2030, half of the world's population, which is going to be approaching 4 billion people, are going to be living within the subtropics. And these are developing nations, and there's very low levels of penetration in air conditioning. And the two factors that are going to really drive, well, I think there's three factors that really drive this. One is urbanization. The other is rising income levels, and then the third is rising temperatures. From my knowledge of the industry and the work and research that we've done, we are on an inevitable pathway of dramatic growth in cooling. And it goes beyond, I think, comfort. It's also about things like health and productivity. And, you know, as we know, at its most extreme, it can also be about survival. especially in very dense urban environments where you have those heat island. You know, this is a problem that's still largely in front of us. So, you know, the positive element coming out of this analysis is it's not so much about fixing what we've already done. It's about fixing what we're about to do with the ramp up of comfort cooling around the world and the technology that is serving that.
Well, this scares me, and I'll tell you why. I worry that instead of moving away from fuels that ruin the atmosphere, we will just keep adapting to the damages. If we all move inside to so-called climate-controlled environments, we risk heading towards that dystopia that director Terry Gilliam portrayed in his 1985 movie Brazil. That made quite an impact on me, that movie. So I wonder if better technology is not really the answer to climate change, but a massive social change will be needed too.
Yeah, so I think that's a great point, Alex. And, you know, as I kind of mentioned earlier, I think this is an and. You know, there's a big thing that we also need to do on behavior. You have to be careful how you say that, but effectively behavior modification, which is, you know, how do we influence people to manage their thermal comfort differently? And, you know, how do we get away from it just has to be, you know, as we talk about here, 72-degree conditioned air, and we can't tolerate anything above or below that. And how does that and why does that make sense? Certainly in many of the areas within the tropics, we're seeing people, governments effectively saying, you know, the thermal comfort, the threshold, we believe should be at 27 degrees centigrade, which is about 80 degrees Fahrenheit. And you shouldn't be cooling spaces below that. And you should dress appropriately. And air movement has an impact. And, you know, we should use fans and, you know, some of these other techniques to achieve thermal comfort and get away from, well, we're just going to have 72 degree condition there. And that's the only thing we need to do. So this is an and. I wouldn't say that having the right technology is on its own is going to solve it and we can happily go on with 72-degree conditioned air. I do believe that we have to do many things to ensure that our energy consumption and the mitigation of rebound effects is actually manageable.
You've just launched this challenge with RMI and Branson and your other partners. Have you seen any feelers of interest yet?
Oh, yeah. We had many of the world's largest manufacturers were at the launch event. We've already had sort of the process is that we initially ask people to register their intent to apply so we can kind of understand the cross-section of who we're going to see applications from, and then later on in the cycle, they'll deliver their technical specifications for review by the technical review committee of the prize. And, you know, we've seen registration by some of the world's largest air conditioning manufacturers, including the world's largest, that has already happened within a week of launch, and also many small innovative players that have been sitting in the shadows of the giant and very much consolidated air conditioning industry. And, you know, one of the things which I should explain is the air conditioning industry has been driven by economies of scale because especially in the residential space, because when the market is buying on lowest price, you get to win if you have lowest cost, and you get to have lowest cost if you have the greatest scale. So, you know, 70% of the world's residential air conditioners are manufactured in China, and half of that is with two companies. And so it's really tough for new technologies to get a foothold or access to the market. And that's one of the things that we're looking to do with the prize is to shine a spotlight on the market so we can see what's in the shadows. And, you know, a number of these small players with some really intriguing technologies have already started stepping out and indicating their intent to apply.
Yes, we have to remember that Apple computers came out of Steve Jobs' garage and not really out of IBM. So there may be some really inventive people out there who could use this challenge to leverage their way up and get us some better air conditioners that don't wreck the climate. We've been speaking with Ian Campbell, a senior fellow at the Rocky Mountain Institute, headquartered in Boulder, Colorado. You can find out a lot more at rmi.org. I will put links to their new report, Solving the Global Cooling Challenge, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ian, thank you so much for informing us about this.
Thanks for the opportunity, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Bitcoin and blockchain, they're breaking tech used by a growing public, even though few of us understand how cryptocurrency even works. Now we find out this new money could be a threat to our future climate if it unfolds as it might. Let me just read from this University of Hawaii press release, quote, "A new study published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Climate Change finds that if Bitcoin is implemented at similar rates at which other technologies have been incorporated, it alone could produce enough emissions to raise global temperature by 2 degrees C as soon as 2033, end quote. 2033. Now, if that's true, that's shocking stuff. And to find out more, we've reached a co-author of the new study, master's student Randy Collins from Honolulu. Randy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, how is it going, Alex?
It's going well here, but it got me wondering, you're part of the Department of Biology. Why are you also part of a new study on Bitcoin?
So I am in the biology department working on my master's and transitioning to a PhD. However, I'm also very interested in climate change and the effects on species diversity and conservation of organisms on the planet. And there was an opportunity to join a group of colleagues, interdisciplinary, so people from different departments that bring different expertise, and work on large-scale analysis of a broad pressing issue. So I joined the group, and there in the group we discussed ideas and what issues we're presenting currently and where, what kind of data we have to analyze. So that's how I got involved with this project regarding Bitcoin.
I've never used it. Have you ever used Bitcoin personally? And if so, how easy is that transaction, say, compared to using a credit card to pay for something?
I have not made a purchase with Bitcoin. I personally have not made a transaction with Bitcoin. However, looking into the platform and being familiar, it's quite easy to complete a transaction, especially now. There are many applications that you can use to process your transactions, and many websites that you can go to access the Bitcoin platform. So it's much like using a debit or credit card online.
Well, I heard an interview on National Public Radio, and Douglas McCauley was suggesting that some Greens really like the blockchain tech behind Bitcoin. They think it could help track many complex things like carbon emissions or reforestation. It was sort of a rah-rah thing, but they haven't heard your science. Now, should people accept cryptocurrency and blockchain as the next big thing, as a way to help the planet? What are your concerns about that?
That's something that we looked into. Blockchain technology, when it was developed, it took about over 10 years for it to be implemented into a currency, right? Bitcoin took existing blockchain technology and developed it into this decentralized cashless payment system, which has a lot of pros associated with it, just kind of taking out the middleman, reducing third-party fees and whatnot. Blockchain technology in and of itself is a great innovation, and I think it can propel us forward. However, in the case of Bitcoin, when using this blockchain technology, there's an associated proof of work that must occur And it basically, it verifies the transactions that occur on the Bitcoin platform. And it is that proof of work process that is so incredibly energy consumptive. So that's where the problem lies with the verification process. There are other alternatives to proof of work, however, and some cryptocurrencies use these alternatives, such as proof of stake or a hybrid of proof of work and proof of stake. So cutting out the proof of work or modifying the structure of the proof of work can drastically reduce the resulting CO2 emissions.
All right, so we better stop and go back a little bit. Now, I make a transaction, and that somehow is gathered up into blocks. And where does the proof of work come in, and why do we need it? Why is it being used?
So the Bitcoin platform is decentralized, right? Meaning there is not a bank that oversees the process or a centralized entity that oversees the transactions. So it's all of the members of Bitcoin community can access, we'll call it a ledger, right? A record of all transactions through the history of Bitcoin. So every member of Bitcoin can access this ledger and verify it. So as you mentioned, a transaction goes into a block. So if I want to send you $5, I announce that to the platform. I put that out there. All Bitcoin members can see this transaction, and we need someone called a miner. So Bitcoin miners take the transaction, put it in a block. Then they need to verify that block before the transaction can be complete. So before I can send you that $5, I announce it, it needs to be verified, so that I don't send you $5 while I send three other people $5, and then I don't have any money left after one person gets the $5, right? So to verify that process, after a miner puts transactions into a block, and a block has a limit on how much data can go into each block, so X amount of transactions allowed, that verification process occurs through a complicated algorithm that needs to be solved. We call this a cryptographic hash function. And so a miner uses a computer, a mining rig, to solve this complicated algorithm. And that takes about 10 minutes on average to solve each block. And that is the energy consumptive process, that complicated algorithm being solved for.
Well, yes, and your paper goes into the economics of this, pointing out that in May 2018, doing the proof of work for a single block would pay out about $116,000 U.S. for that 10 minutes of computing time. And I thought, wow, that sounds pretty profitable. And according to a site called digeconomist.net that tracks such things, 23% of that payout is profit. So that's a pretty high profit margin. It makes me wonder why every server farm in the world isn't just out there processing Bitcoin data and making big money.
Right. I mean, it has become very profitable with the value of Bitcoin increasing. More people join the platform to mine Bitcoin, right? So in the early days of Bitcoin, 2009 most miners were just folks at home using personal computers, CPUs. However, the way Bitcoin works for the proof of work, let me back that up a little bit. The genesis idea of Bitcoin was to have a block solved about every 10 minutes, right? So if you add more people to the platform and the difficulty of solving the block stays the same, the block will be solved faster with more people. So the Bitcoin network is set up where the more folks that join the Bitcoin platform and mine to solve the blocks, the more difficult the algorithm becomes to keep that 10-minute interval on average between blocks solved. So the more difficult the algorithm is, the harder the mining rigs need to work and the more electricity it takes to solve these blocks. And because of that, it is incredibly expensive to mine for Bitcoin now. So we've moved from using CPUs, people started adopting GPUs to mine Bitcoin in about 2011, something called field programmable gate arrays, FPGAs, came on the market. Folks started using these to mine for Bitcoin. And now, in late 2011, something called an ASIC, an application-specific integrated circuit, is now the standard, the gold standard for mining Bitcoin. So what the ASIC is, it's a piece of hardware that is built and designed specifically to mine Bitcoin, the cryptographic hash function associated with Bitcoin. These ASICs are incredibly powerful, and they solve for 14 terahashes a second. That's astronomical, literally. And they're incredibly energy consumptive to supply the power to do these processes. And so that factors in a high electricity bill. So the cost it takes to mine for Bitcoin has now kind of pushed out the little guys, right? Anyone at home wanting to mine on their computer, they don't really stand a chance with all of these ASICs mining Bitcoin now.
And it's mind-blowing, but then we get to the bottom line. What is the estimate of greenhouse gas emissions for the Bitcoin industry for 2017?
Yeah, so all of the data for Bitcoin is accessible. You can access that. You can see every block solved and added to the blockchain since the history of Bitcoin in 2009. There are currently over 500,000 blocks on this blockchain. So we accessed the 2017 data, and with every block, you can see how many transactions were in that block and who won the block, right? So what miner won the block, whether it's a mining pool, so a group of people that work together, or an individual. So we use that data, and we found the country that the mining pool or individual is associated with, and looked at their main source of electricity, so their energy fuel mix, and use that to calculate the CO2 emissions per block. All in all, we calculated that in 2017, Bitcoin usage emitted 69 megaton of carbon dioxide equivalent. So that's quite a lot of carbon emissions. Seen it referred to as equivalent to about 17 power plants. So that's from 1 year with Bitcoin.
17 power plants going full out 24/7 just to process Bitcoin, and we're still in the infancy of this cryptocurrency, and it could blow up much bigger than that, and that's really the point of your paper is, what happens when it does blow up much bigger than that? So what kind of projections did you work with, and how did you come to the frightening 2-degree mark coming so soon?
Bitcoin, we looked at Bitcoin as it's been adopted, right, as a new technology emerges. If it becomes broadly adopted, we mirrored that to other broadly adopted technologies, right? And so we took about 40 other broadly adopted technologies and analyzed their trajectory, so their rate of adoption over time. And we used things like common household appliances, washing machines, water heaters, e-book readers, electric power, color TVs, etc. So,
now, can I just stop you for a second? Were those adoption rates just for the United States or globally, or how did you work that out?
We took the 40 different technologies, and the data came from the United States reference, and then the credit card data also from the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. That's where our data was drawn from for these other technologies.
That's a fascinating subset of this paper right on its own. I mean, just looking at how fast technologies move out into society and what percentage of the population use them. And as you say, it's color TVs, it's power steering, it's smartphones, and it's air conditioning, all sorts of interesting things. But I have to wonder, adoption rates by larger populations will be the key, like India, China, Brazil, and they may be faster than it happened in the United States because it's all known already, or it may be slower because people can't afford it. How could you predict global rates for technologies used in this study and then project from that Bitcoin usage?
There have been a few analyses of the electricity consumption of Bitcoin, and we referenced a couple of them in our paper. You had actually mentioned the Digiconomist website, and Digiconomist does do estimates for Bitcoin energy consumption. Also, a paper by Fontanus that came out in 2018, I believe, looked at the energy consumption. So, but they use different methods for analyzing this. So we thought about all of the approaches that we could take to look at the energy consumption and then our prediction power going forward. And we are unable to predict the fate of Bitcoin, but we wanted to look at if it did follow the rate of other broadly used technologies, whether they be quickly adopted or adopted on a much more slow pace, what the outcome could be. And so looking at Bitcoin on these trajectories, it's still an astounding number, even if Bitcoin follows the most slowly adopted technologies that we analyzed. It still produces, you know, the emissions necessary to reach that 2-degree threshold in about 22 years, if it follows the slowest broadly adopted technologies. We decided this would be a good way to look at the Bitcoin future.
Well, this is so weird because we are looking in official papers at the IPCC of getting to 2-degree warming or trying to stay under that by 2100. But now we're talking, and when we worry about those things, we usually worry about things like deforestation, the loss of Arctic sea ice, and other major factors. But just the introduction of a new technology, if it goes viral and if it keeps going and succeeds at the rates of other technologies, that could do us over the 2-degree danger zone by in 22 years. I mean, that's amazing that we could have that happen in a human population.
Maybe the reality of climate change and its subsequent effects, like changing climates, increased natural disasters, food, crop shortages, etc., drought, might just seem a little unrealistic to many people, right? It's hard to imagine that happening. And it isn't new. We've been aware of this problem for decades. And now we're kind of at this critical point. We need to take action. And somebody asked me recently, why should we worry about Bitcoin? We have these other issues, right? Deforestation, agriculture, fossil fuels. And it's not a choice to pick one or the other, right? We just need to focus on all of these issues. Now, currently, Bitcoin is not at the level of those big emission polluters that I just mentioned. But if it does follow these rates of adoption, it could happen. And as you mentioned, all other emerging technologies potentially could carry the same fate. So this study is really important to me as it can highlight the importance of assessing emerging technologies and upcoming sectors of development and keeping the carbon footprint in mind, right? Being aware and engineering into your technology mitigation strategies, because we are at this critical point, definitely.
I think any time humans make a change, we have to be aware of success, of what happens if something really takes off. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Randy Rollins from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And we're talking about how Bitcoin could break the climate bank, so to speak. And Randy is co-author of a new paper in Nature Climate Change titled, Bitcoin Emissions Alone Could Push Global Warming Above 2 Degrees C. Your paper does touch on several solutions, and I suppose the first way to avoid 2 degrees with Bitcoin is that this digital currency fails, perhaps spectacularly. Is that still a possibility?
Bitcoin is a volatile market, right? We see it jump up and skyrocket in value for Bitcoin and then decrease, but there is a general trend in an increase. And I can't predict the fate of Bitcoin. I think that the idea, the technology, decentralized cash payment systems is a way of the future. And it just needs to be, the emissions need to be mitigated, right? And I mentioned when we first started speaking, Alex, that Bitcoin uses a proof of work to verify transactions so that we can make payments to each other on the Bitcoin network. If that proof of work is changed into a proof of stake verification process, that could drastically reduce the CO2 emissions. So that's one way to mitigate this issue. Also with Bitcoin, something like I mentioned in a block, there's a cap to the number of transactions that can go into the block. Actually, technically, it's the amount of data that can be inserted into a block. If we raise that cap, so if more transactions can fit into a block, that would drastically reduce the emissions associated with Bitcoin as well. So there are alternatives to this issue. Also, using green, sustainable energy sources would completely mitigate these problems, as well as other sectors and industry. So I think using green renewable resources is key for the future of Bitcoin or any other cashless payment.
Yeah, so why couldn't we just move the data mining to a place that uses renewable energy? But I guess you'd have to have governments mandating that. And I also wonder about gaining efficiency in the actual computers used to do this. I mean, the manufacturer of Bitmain's Antminer S9 computer claimed their new model has 3 times the power and twice the efficiency of their previous S7 model. So maybe also hardware improvements. But I guess those hardware improvements are never going to keep up if Bitcoin, you know, like Walmart starts adopting it and Amazon, both those don't accept it right now. But if they did, then it could just balloon way out there.
Right. If a large corporations adopt Bitcoin payment, then the system would become flooded and we would need more people to join the network to mine the blocks to verify the transactions, right? So we would be inputting a much greater need for electricity, increasing those demands. And yes, improving the hardware for mining Bitcoin could reduce these electricity draws, right? But we've seen improvement over time, but it's not enough. Like in 2017, right, 69 megatons of carbon just from mining Bitcoin. And we're not calculating the electricity required to keep the equipment cool. That's a whole nother part of this that we didn't factor in. So our numbers are actually conservative in that regard.
And, you know, we talked about the possibility of Bitcoin crashing, but another way that cryptocurrency could really take off is if, in fact, it's the regular currencies, the dollar, the yen, or any other currency could crash so badly that the population flees to Bitcoin and maybe economic difficulties push that warming footprint way out as well.
That's an interesting thought, you know, by necessity, joining the Bitcoin network with the crash of other currencies, right? So Bitcoin is the most well-known cryptocurrency, the large cryptocurrency. And as I mentioned, there are actually hundreds of different cryptocurrencies available of varying platform sizes. And I believe Ethereum, which is another popular cryptocurrency, transitioned to this other verification process, proof of stake. So if cryptocurrencies can do that, if Bitcoin can make that transition or other proofs are developed, methods for verification, then that can help circumvent the issue. Like if the scenario you just proposed, if people flock to these decentralized payment systems due to a fiat currency crash, then that could help prepare us for that.
And another weird part of this whole story is that it seems Bitcoin in particular has also succeeded because it can evade government monitoring or control, and thus it's often been used to move money made by crime or corruption. And if crime or corruption increases, that too could push more Bitcoins and thus add to global warming. Isn't that a strange twist?
Yeah, I guess my thoughts on that are the underground dealings, purchases on Silk Road and et cetera on the deep web are unintended consequences of having a decentralized cash payment system. However, I think that these illegal or shady dealings occur in our society regardless of what monetary system we're using. Kind of if there's a will, there's a way, and it's going to happen. And, you know, I don't know what the direct effect on CO2 emissions or climate change would be from increasing crime, but certainly when folks are wrapped up in, you know, a criminal world or under punishment for criminal activities, then it's more difficult to contribute to decarbonization or climate change mitigation practices. So, yeah, that's another aspect to think about.
One thing I really like about this paper is hardly anybody asks when a new technology appears, hey, what happens if this really succeeds? And you've done that, and I like the analysis of other technologies and how fast they expanded. Was there a particular person at the University of Hawaii who really asked this question and said, hey, we've got to look at Bitcoin and see what's going on there?
Yeah, Alex, I'm really glad you asked this. So there was a small group of us that came together to do this large-scale analysis on a broad issue that I had mentioned when we first started speaking. And one of my colleagues on this project, her name is Katie Talladay. She is a PhD student in the geography department here at UH Manoa. And she actually proposed the idea of looking at Bitcoin. We came together for a meeting and she brought it to the table one day. She, you know, Bitcoin had been kind of in the news. People have been, a lot of to-do had been going on about Bitcoin, and she put two and two together and brought it to the table. I started looking into the impacts of Bitcoin. I've been interested and fascinated by this system for probably since about 2012 or 2013. However, I was completely unaware of the electricity demand and resulting emissions from this platform. So when I started digging into it and all of us in the group looked at this, I think we were all very surprised. So Katie Talladay brought the idea to the table, and we thank her for that.
As we wrap this up, Randy, are you going back to biology studies, or have you always been continuing them anyway, or has the digital world captured your attention?
So, you know, yes and yes. So I'm still working in the realm of biology and conservation. So climate change goes hand in hand in what I'm looking at, species diversity. However, technology is incredibly interesting. I use a lot of technology for modeling, but as for continuing my studies in the Bitcoin world, we'll see what comes of that. I'm not sure if it's in the future or not yet.
From Honolulu, we've been talking with Randy Rollins from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. She is co-author of a paper led by Radio EcoShock guest Camilo Mora, titled Bitcoin Emissions Alone Could Push Global Warming Above 2 Degrees C, and that was published on October 29, 2018 in the journal Nature Climate Change, a prestigious journal. Randy, thank you so much for helping us through the unknown side of secret money.
Thank you so much. It's been a joy being able to talk with you about this.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. In addition to our radio audience around the world, my California Fire special blog resulted in over 8,000 audio downloads. Our guest, Mariah Gallardon, host of TUC Radio, reports the fires are mostly out after an atmospheric river almost drowned California. If those rains had just come 2 weeks earlier, hundreds of lives might have been saved in the little town of Paradise. Sometimes climate change can lengthen a season by 2 weeks or delay rains, and that is how much 2 weeks can matter. Right now, Mariah doesn't want to try the mud-soaked roads at the ranch. Without trees, the burned hills are slipping down, carbon is running into every creek, and local rivers are running black. The spotlight of world media will move on, but for a lot of folks in Northern California, there is nowhere to move to except away. Now it is Australia's turn in the climate barrel. The east coast of that country experienced record heat, and then fires too large and too fast for anyone to control. As the world warms and winds shift, the earth becomes more flammable.
What do we do when the water is gone? What do we do when the trees are gone? What do we do with this hole in the sky and the pollution in the air? What are we gonna do? What are we gonna do, you and I?
Expanding Australian coal sales will kill millions of people and create millions of climate refugees. On Friday, November 30th, thousands of Australian students walked out of class to protest government inaction on climate. Give them power and let it spread. What are you going to do?